I want to continue in volume 2 with March the 14th, 1899. The evil of man forces God to chastise him. This morning, my sweet Jesus, transporting me with him, this is in an out-of-the-body experience for Louisa, made me see the multiplicity of the sins that are committed. They were such and so many that it is impossible to describe them. I could also see a star of enormous magnitude in the air, and within its roundness it contained black fire and blood. Well, you do know that in late 20th century that what they call the planet X, or the 10th planet, also called Nibiru, was discovered. And after that, then NASA wanted to pretend it didn't happen because it was causing such fear around the world. This planet is so very much bigger than planet Earth, and its orbit takes about 2,600 years, and it's on its way. So the black fire and blood would make enormous sense if this planet is coming close to us. The damage it will do will be colossal. Louisa says it would strike so much fear and fright, even looking at it, that it seemed that death would be the lesser evil than to live in these times so sad. In other places, one could see volcanoes with their mouths opening, which are also to inundate the country nearby. So there are a lot of volcanoes in Italy. That's what she means by the country nearby. One could also see sectarian people. Now, it's a strange expression that she uses, but since Italy was Catholic, sectarian people have to be the communists and the Freemasons, who will also go on causing fires. Now, fire doesn't mean just setting a house on fire. It means trouble of all kinds. While I was seeing this, my beloved and afflicted Jesus told me, "Have you seen how much they offend me and what I keep prepared?" That means the judgment that's waiting for them if they really push divine justice that far. "I am withdrawing from man." Now, this is the worst punishment of all. If you go to Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11, you'll see that the Spirit of God actually lifted up from the temple in chapter 10, hovered over the temple because it was his home on earth, and then left. And on that particular occasion, the people repented. And so in chapter 11, the Spirit of God comes back and takes up his residence in the temple. When you read Romans chapter 1 and St. Paul speaks about the dreadful, dreadful corruption of the city of Rome in his day, three times he says God left them to their terrible practices, God left them to their terrible immorality, and God left them. Now, that means, of course, that the empire of Rome was going to fall, and it did. As he was saying this, we both withdrew into my bed, and I could see that because of this withdrawal of Jesus, people would give themselves over to the most awful actions and more murders. That's what happens, you see, when grace is withdrawn, because God is grace. Grace is an outpouring of God. And if grace is removed, then people are worse than animals. Once we had withdrawn, Jesus seemed to place himself in my heart, and he began to cry and sob, saying, "O man, how much I have loved you. If you knew how I grieve to have to chastise you." So Jeremiah 31:3, "I have loved you with an everlasting love, and I am constant in my affection for you." Even God's justice is love, because all of God's attributes are equal and they are all intermingled as one. For example, justice is merciful, because if you get justice on the earth, maybe you might repent and you won't go to hell. Justice is wise, because it treats you properly on the earth so that you don't lose your soul, and so on. But we think that mercy means being let off the hook, and that God doesn't call us to account. But mercy is just. And mercy is wise. And mercy is prudent and all the rest of it. And love is just and love is kind and love is merciful as well. So all the attributes of God intermingle. If you only knew how I grieve in having to chastise you, Jesus said, but my justice forces me to do this. Oh man, how I cry and grieve over your lot. And then he burst into tears again and he would repeat those words because he loves us. John 15:9. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. So this love is infinite, absolute, eternal. And so, of course, Jesus would grieve over the way we are destroying ourselves as individuals, societies and the world. Who can say the pity, the fear, the torment that arose in my soul, especially in seeing Jesus so afflicted and crying? I did as much as I could to hide my sorrow, and in order to console him, I said to him, O Lord, it will never be that you will chastise man. Holy spouse, do not cry. Just as you have done the other times, you will do now. You will pour your justice into me. You see, that's the incredible mercy that God has given to the human race, that he calls victim souls who will stand between his divine justice and the human race. You will make me suffer so that your justice will not force you to chastise the rest of them. Jesus would continue crying and I would repeat, but listen to me a little bit. Have you not put me in this bed so that I might be a victim soul for others? You have to add the word soul because the word victim gives a different message today. Have I perhaps not been ready to suffer the other times so as to spare them? Why do you not want to listen to me now? And with all my poor words, my book says, speaking, but words is a better rendition. With all my poor words, Jesus couldn't calm himself from crying. So no longer able to hold it, I too broke the dike of my crying, saying to him, Lord, if your intention is to chastise them, I too do not have the heart to see them suffer so much. Therefore, if you truly want to send the scourges, and my sins no longer make me worthy to suffer in the place of others, I want to come. Put there 2 Corinthians 5:8. We are full of confidence and actually want to be exiled from the body and make our home with the Lord. I want to be on this earth no more. Then the confessor came and called me to obedience and Jesus withdrew and that's how it ended. The following morning, I kept seeing Jesus withdrawn within my heart, and I saw that people would come even inside my heart and would tread upon him and trample him underfoot. I would do as much as I could to free him, and Jesus, turning to me, said, do you see? Do you see where the gratitude of man actually reaches? They themselves force me to chastise them. And I cannot do otherwise. And you, my dear one, after you've seen me suffer so much, may you hold crosses more dearly and pains as delights. That's Hebrews 12:2. To hold pains as delight does not mean, of course, that you don't suffer, that you don't feel the pain, but that you know the value of it. So Hebrews 12:2 says that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame of it. So March the 18th, 1899, charity is simple. I want to give you 1 John 4:7. God is love. So charity or divine love is simple. So just make sure you write down divine love there, that it's not human love you're talking about. This morning, my beloved Jesus continued to make himself seen from within my heart. And in seeing him a little bit more cheered, I plucked up courage. And I began to pray that he would not send so many chastisements. And Jesus asked me, what moves you, my daughter, to pray not to chastise the creatures? In other words, what's your intention? Now, in all of these writings, your intention is extremely important. It's not what you do, it's why you do it. That is terribly important. And therefore, all of us have to get to the point of being able to confess in confession, I did such and such a thing for this reason. This is why I did it. And if we can confess, this is why I did it, we are actually getting places because the priest will know how to help you to repent. Immediately, Louise answered, because they are your images. And if the creatures should suffer, you yourself would suffer. So the images of God is Genesis 1:27 and Romans 8:29. And Jesus, heaving a sigh, said, ah, its divine love is so dear to me, 1 John 3:2, that you cannot understand it. Divine love is simple, just like my being, which though immense is yet most simple. You'll read that also in Wisdom chapter 7. So much so that there is no place in which it does not penetrate. So I keep on saying divine love so you don't misunderstand the word charity, because charity is used, bandied around today, and it has lost its extraordinary meaning. So divine love being very simple, it diffuses everywhere. And you'll also read, you know, that the divine light is so very simple that it diffuses everywhere. But the divine light and the divine love are one. They're the same person. It has regard for no one, whether a friend or an enemy, whether a citizen or a stranger. It loves everyone. It loves without limits. This is love without borders. And what Jesus is demanding of us is love without borders. That's 1 Corinthians 14:1. Matthew 5:34-38, that we must be perfect like our Heavenly Father is perfect. So March the 9th, 1899. The devil can speak about virtue, but he cannot infuse it into the soul. Now, this is important for discernment. This morning, as Jesus made himself seen, I was afraid it might not be truly Jesus, but the devil who wanted to deceive me. And after I made my usual protests, Jesus began to speak. Now, there's a little note here saying, protest is not intended as an act of disapproval or dissent, but as an interior affirmation of the soul, an oath of her intention of consenting to no temptation to the enemy. In volume one, Louisa writes, Jesus Christ taught me that the most effective means for the soul to be freed of every vain apprehension, of every doubt, of every fear, was to protest before heaven, earth, and the very demons that she does not want to offend God. That's an extremely important point. And if you want to overcome temptations quickly, just make that declaration. She calls it a protest, but in actual fact, it should be called a declaration. And that is, we say, before heaven, earth and hell, I want to declare before the Father, before all the angels and saints, and before all creatures on earth and all demons in hell, that I want to love God only. I want to serve him only. I want to love him only. I will not, under any circumstances, consent to sin. That's the declaration or the protest that she's actually talking about. So after she made her declaration, then Jesus said to her, daughter, do not fear, for I am not the devil. Besides, he, if he speaks about virtue, it's a coloured thing. Coloured meaning something you colour on a page. In other words, there's no reality to it. It's not real virtue. Nor does he have the power of infusing it into the soul. He can only talk about it. We say of people who can only talk about things and never do anything that they're all mouth. A lovely expression that I've come across from the pharaohs in Egypt is a windbag. In other words, there's no reality there. You can stick a pin in it and the wind goes out. So the devil is a windbag. He's only talking about something that doesn't mean anything. And if sometimes the devil shows that he wants to make the soul practice a little bit of good, she, the soul, is not persevering because there's no grace involved. And in the very act in which the soul does that little bit of good, she's listless and agitated because there's no grace there. It's not coming from God. I alone have the power to infuse myself in her heart. That means to infuse grace, power, wisdom, understanding, fortitude, knowledge, and so on. I alone have the power to infuse myself in her heart, to make her practice virtues, and to get her to suffer with courage, tranquility and perseverance. Now, the devil won't help you to suffer, and certainly not to suffer with perseverance and constancy for God. And then, when is the devil ever gone in search of virtues? His hunting is for vices. That's his thing. And to bring down the human race. Therefore, don't fear and be tranquil. So March the 20th, 1899. This morning, Jesus transported me out of myself and showed me so many people all in discord. They're out of God's order. And if you look at the beginning of this volume and any volume of Louisa, you will see the declaration that this is all about the call of the creature to return to the order, the place and the purpose for which God had created it. So disorder means out of God's will. Man doing his own thing. Oh, how much this grieved Jesus, Louisa said. In seeing him suffer so much, I prayed him to pour it into me. But since he still continues in wanting to chastise the world, he did not pour it into me. However, after I prayed and prayed him to make me content, he poured a little bit. And then, being a little relieved, he told me, the reason why the world has reduced itself to such a sad state is that it has lost subordination to leaders. And also the first leader is God. Now, I want you to know that he's talking about the death of obedience. When Satan is around, there will be no obedience. And here we are in the third millennium and religious life has disintegrated because there's no obedience. The church is falling apart because there's no obedience. Everybody does their own thing. Society is falling apart. You have to do your own thing. You have to assert yourself. It's you yourself that you're serving, worshipping and all the rest of it. And the selfie, to me, is the image of self-worship today. It's frightening. So the fact that there's no obedience, no acceptance of God's order. And the first leader is God, against whom they have rebelled. So therefore, they, meaning the human beings, have rebelled against the Ten Commandments. Well, by now in the third millennium, our governments have made the Ten Commandments obsolete. It's actually legal to be immoral. And then he said, it happened as a consequence that they have lost any subjection to or dependence on the church, the laws, and all the others are said to be leaders. Because they've no obedience to God, of course, obedience to the church is gone as well. And therefore, everybody's doing their own thing. And the most perfect illustration of that are the demonstrations we have witnessed in which women have said, nobody will tell me what to do with my body. They have no idea the level of rebellion that is actually there. And they don't appear to think that their bodies were given to them. Everything is gift. Ah, my daughter, what will happen to so many members infected by this bad example of the very ones who are said to be leaders, that is, superiors, parents, and many others? Ah, they will reach such a point that neither parents, nor brothers, nor kings, nor princes will be recognized anymore, which of course has happened. These members will be like many vipers that will poison one another. Therefore, see how necessary chastisement are in these times and how necessary it is for death to almost destroy this sort of people so that the few who will be left may learn at the expense of the others to be humble and obedient. So let me do not want to oppose my chastising the people. Now, if you want to see the chaos that comes into society where everybody's doing their own will and not God's will, and the deterioration that happens in families and in society, read 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 to 5. It's very sobering. Also read Revelation 11, 18, where the Lord says that he will destroy the destroyers of the earth. So the Lord says that certain poisonous plants have to be removed in order to let the ones that still have some health live. And so the chastisements are actually very selective. The people in areas where disasters have happened wouldn't think that at all. March the 31st, 1899, and this is the value of suffering. This morning, my adorable Jesus made himself seen crucified, and after he communicated his pains to me, he told me, "Many are the wounds that made me suffer during my passion, but the cross is just one reality." This means that many are the roads through which I draw souls to perfection, but one is the heaven in which these souls must unite. Now, the English very often is very poor because the adverbs and the nouns are put in the wrong place for the English language. So Jesus is saying that even though he had thousands of sufferings, the mystery of the cross is one reality. And he says, even though heaven is the destiny for all human beings, there are many roads to get there. And even people who are together in one class, they may be on different roads to heaven as well. Because that's like saying you can travel to Dublin, but you may not travel on the motorways. You might travel the country roads. You might decide to go through the small towns on your way. There are different ways of getting there. And even entering the city, you can enter it from different angles and so on. Well, that's the way it is spiritually, that we take different roads to heaven. So this heaven that we are aiming at has different places in it, more or less glorious. So I want to give you John 14:2 for that. In my Father's house, there are many mansions, and there is one for you. And these places will be distributed according to the sufferings suffered down here on earth, more or less heavy. Oh, if all knew the preciousness of suffering, they would compete with one another to suffer more. But this knowledge, the word in my book says science, this knowledge is not recognized by the world, and so they abhor all that can make them richer for eternity. So there are many roads to heaven, but you won't get there without the cross. These writings are completely clear that you cannot get there without the cross. If you reject the cross, you've rejected the journey. And people accept the cross at different levels. Some people just put up with it. Some people rebel against it. Some people resign themselves. Some people actually agree and they allow the cross to do its purifying work inside of us. And Jesus says the more deeply the cross is allowed to do that purifying work in us, the greater will be your place in heaven, because all the purification is supposed to happen on the earth. It's not supposed to happen in purgatory. And purgatory is just a very severe mercy on the part of God for those who went to the other side not fully prepared. So Louisa continues, "After going through several days of privation and tears, I found myself all confused and annihilated within myself. In my interior, I kept saying continuously, 'Tell me, O my good, why have you moved away from me? Where have I offended you that you no longer make yourself seen? And if you show yourself, you are almost concealed and silent. Oh, please do not make me wait and wait any longer, for my heart cannot take any more.'" Now, this is only volume 2. We're at the very beginning, and there's 36 volumes altogether. So Louisa, at this point, doesn't understand what she calls the privation, and it will be called the privation for the whole of these volumes. And that is that Jesus is not showing himself to her in this extraordinary way that he showed before, and so she suffers desperately. But she's going to learn as she goes along that her biggest cross, never mind all the sufferings she agrees to and all the rest of it, but her biggest cross is actually this privation. And Jesus will explain to her in higher volumes that she does in fact experience the pain of purgatory, and sometimes even the pain of hell. Both pains are the pain of the loss of God. And she will learn eventually how to use it for the good of souls. Finally, Jesus showed himself a little more clearly, and in seeing me so annihilated, devastated we would say, he told me, "If you knew how much I like humility," well, go to Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 to 30. "Humility is the littlest plant that can be found, but its branches are so high that they reach heaven. They wind their way around my throne and they penetrate deep into my heart. This little plant is humility, and the branches which this plant produces are confidence. So there cannot be true humility without confidence. Humility without confidence is false virtue. From the words of Jesus, it shows that my heart not only annihilated, it was also a little discouraged. And so you need to write down the two words humility and confidence, because you're going to hear an awful lot more about them. In fact, as you go to the higher volumes, it's not just humility that Jesus will ask for, but he will ask us to acknowledge our nothingness, that by comparison with him, we are literally nothing, and that he creates out of nothing. And so if we would throw ourselves into our nothingness, then he will be able to create a wonderful new thing in us and through us. So he is introducing the subject here in the early volumes, because volumes 1 to 4 are the foundations of this great mysterious journey that brings so much glory to God. So April the 5th, 1899, how Jesus keeps her concealed in his love. My soul continues in its annihilation and fear of losing sweet Jesus, when in one instant he made himself seen all of a sudden. And he told me, I keep you in the shadow of love. Now the word is charity on the page. It's divine love we're talking about. Since a shadow penetrates everywhere, my love keeps you concealed everywhere and in everything. Now that confirms that I'm talking about divine love, because only divine love is everywhere and in everything. So if Louisa is held in the arms of divine love, divine love is everywhere and in everything. What do you fear then? How can I leave you when I keep you so sunken within my love? And of course, God is love, so it means that she's absolutely absorbed in God. While Jesus was saying this, I wanted to ask him why he was not making himself seen as usual, but Jesus disappeared from me immediately and did not give me the time to tell him even a word. You can see from this response of Louisa that she hasn't grasped that Jesus has answered her question. She wants to know why she's not seeing him all the time. And he says, but you are literally absorbed in me. That's like you pour a drop of water into a bucket of water. You're not going to be able to see the drop of water anymore because it's completely absorbed by the rest of it. And he's telling her something incredible here, but she can't hear it. And that's because she's suffering. April the 7th, 1899, Louisa refreshes Jesus. So she says, I continue in the same state, but this morning especially it seemed most bitter to me. I'd almost lost the hope that Jesus would come again. So you need to put beside that Psalm 63, which laments the Lord's absence. O God, you are my God, for you I love, for you my soul is thirsty. Even my body pines for you like a dry, weary land without water. So she says, how many tears I have shed. That's Psalm 42 as well. I have nothing but tears for my bread night and day, as I hear it said all day long, where is your God? Oh God, what am I going to do? My heart was in such strong pain and continuous throbbing, but so strong that I felt mortal agony. In my interior, I said to him, my good Jesus, don't you yourself see that I feel life missing in me? Now, Louise is not actually exaggerating there, because she's in a bed. There's nothing happening around her. She's not eating as other people eat. She's not sleeping as other people sleep. She has nothing to do except pray and commune with God and write her books, which she finds very difficult to do. And so since she's living this abnormal existence that should have brought her muscle wastage and bed sores and osteoporosis and God knows what else, and she never had any illness except the one from which she died, which was pneumonia in her 80s, the old man's friend, as the doctors say. Okay, so why does she say life is missing in her? And that is that Jesus is literally preserving her body, soul and spirit. He isn't just preserving her spiritually. And so when he is not more actively present to her, she feels that she's actually dying. And she's not exaggerating. My good Jesus, don't you yourself see that life is missing in me? Tell me at least, how can one be without you? How can one live? Though I am ungrateful for so many graces, yet I love you, and I offer you this most bitter pain of your absence to repair for my ingratitude. Now, that's the right thing to do, is to offer the pain for something. But come, she says, have patience, Jesus. You are so good. Don't make me wait anymore. Come. Don't you yourself know what a cruel tyrant love is, and you don't have compassion on me. So what she's saying there is that true love, genuine love, demands union with the beloved, demands unity. True love won't tolerate separation. So while I was in this state, so sorrowful, Jesus came, and all full of compassion, he told me, I've come now, do not cry anymore, come to me. In one instant, I found myself outside of myself together with him. So she's in and out of the body experience. And I looked at him, but with such fear that I might lose him again, that tears would pour in large streams from my eyes. And Jesus continued, no, don't cry anymore. Take a look at how I am suffering. Look at my head, the thorns that have penetrated so deep that they no longer show outside. Do you see how many gashes and blood cover my body? Come close to me and give me refreshment. So what he is doing, he is deflecting her from looking at her own sufferings to look at his. Because if she looks at his sufferings, she knows what to do. And that is that she will take some of these sufferings to herself to give him what he calls a refreshment. Please don't misunderstand. For you and me, a refreshment is a cup of tea or coffee or a drink or something. It's not so for him. A refreshment means that she will take some of his sufferings to relieve him and therefore to save souls. And he will also mitigate chastisements for her as well. So by occupying myself with the pains of Jesus, Louisa said, I forgot about my own, which was the issue. A little bit. And so I started from his head. Oh, how harrowing it was to see those thorns so sunk into his flesh that one could not pull them out. While I was doing that, Jesus would lament, so great was the pain that he suffered. After I pulled the crown of thorns off, all broken, I put it together again. And knowing that the greatest pleasure one can give Jesus is to suffer for him, that's because it will save souls, not because suffering in its own self. I took it and I drove it into my own head. So Louisa was suffering moral and spiritual suffering, and she takes physical suffering on top of that as well. Then he would have me kiss his wounds one by one, and in some of them he would want me to suckle the blood. You will see this in the Hours of the Passion, where you see Jesus doing this on a spiritual level, kissing all the wounds of Jesus in order to make reparation and to save souls. I was trying to do everything he wanted, though in mute silence, when the Most Holy Virgin came and said to me, ask Jesus what he wants to make of you. In other words, there is a program, there is an adventure, there is a calling, there is a vocation. And Louisa is thinking that she has experienced what needs to be experienced, and not at all. There's an incredible journey ahead for her. So Blessed Mother asks her to ask him. I would not dare, she said, but Mother encouraged me to do it. To make her content, I drew my lips near to the ear of Jesus. In a whisper, I said to him, what do you want to make of me? And he answered, I want to make of you the object of my satisfactions. And in the very act of saying these words, he disappeared and I found myself inside of myself. So she gets an answer which isn't an answer, but indicates to her that there is much more to come. She hasn't seen anything yet. Louisa has no idea at this particular point that she's being called into the divine will at such a depth that she herself will be encouraged and graced to open the kingdom of the divine will for the rest of us. She wouldn't have understood those words at this particular point. So April the 9th, 1899, Jesus refreshes her from the pains of his privation. This morning, Jesus made himself seen and transported me into a church. In other words, bilocated her into a church. There I attended Holy Mass and I received communion at the hands of Jesus. After this, I clung to his feet, but so strongly that I could not detach myself. The thought of the pains of the past days, that is, of the privation of Jesus, made me fear so much that I might lose him again, that while at his feet, I cried and I said, "This time, Jesus, I will not leave you any more, because when you go away from me, you make me suffer so much." So I want to give you Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. And I also want to give you John 20, verses 1 to 10, where Mary of Magdala did exactly the same thing on Easter Day. She threw herself at the feet of Jesus and clung to him, and she didn't want to let him go. But in both cases, Jesus went, because we can't cling to him like that. Jesus told me, "Come into my arms, for I want to refresh you from the pains of the past days." So in the last message, she refreshed Jesus from his pains. Now he refreshes her also. I almost did not dare to do it, but Jesus stretched out his hands and raised me from his feet. He hugged me and he said, "Do not fear, for I won't leave you." That's Joshua 1:5. Hebrews 13:5. "This morning I want to make you content. Come and stay with me in the tabernacle." I want to give you John 14:18. "And so we both withdrew into the tabernacle." That of course, is Louise's soul, not her body. "Who can say what we did? He would kiss me and I him, and then I would rest in him and Jesus in me. And I would see the offences that he received in the most holy Eucharist, understood, because they're in the tabernacle, and would make acts of reparation for the different offences." Who can express the patience of Jesus in this most holy sacrament? It is so great that it is frightening just to think about it. But while I was doing this, Jesus made me see the confessor who was coming to call me into myself. He told me, "Enough now, go, for obedience is calling you." It seemed that my soul would return to my body, and indeed the confessor was calling me to obedience. So April the 12th, 1899, Jesus says, "Being in the most blessed sacrament for me is the same as being in your heart." This is terribly important. Today, without having me wait so long, Jesus came quickly and he told me, "You are my tabernacle." That is 1 Corinthians 3:16. "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that God dwells in you?" Being in the most holy Eucharist for me is the same as being in your heart. Or rather, in you I find something more. I'm able to share my pains with you and to have you with me, a living victim soul before the divine justice, which of course I don't find in the tabernacle. And while saying these words, he enclosed himself within me. So the tabernacle is a dead thing, there's no response, and the heart is the living tabernacle, and he only tolerates the dead tabernacle in order to come into our hearts and reign there, the living tabernacles. So while within me, Jesus would make me feel the pricks of the thorns and the pains of the cross and the labours and the sufferings of his heart. Around his heart, I could see a braid of iron spikes, which made Jesus suffer very much. How much pity I felt in seeing him suffer this way. I would have wanted to suffer everything myself rather than let my sweet Jesus suffer. And from the heart, I prayed to him to give his pains and sufferings to me. Then he told me, "Daughter, the offences which most pierced my heart are the masses that are said sacrilegiously and the hypocrisies of the priests." Who can say what I understood about these two words? It seemed to me that externally one shows that he loves and praises the Lord, but internally he has poison ready to kill him. Externally, one shows that he wants the glory and honour of God, but internally he sees his own honour and esteem. All works done with hypocrisy, even the holiest ones, are works completely poisoned, which embitter the heart of Jesus. So, first of all, I want to give you Matthew 23, where Jesus absolutely castigated the scribes and Pharisees for their hypocrisy. They had the holy robes, they had the holy jobs that our cardinals, bishops and priests have today. They were carrying out the holy liturgies as our cardinals, bishops and priests are today. And yet they were the very ones that Jesus condemned absolutely. While when ordinary sinners came to him, he was compassionate with them because they were only weak and therefore they were prepared to open their hearts to him and to come to him and receive the grace of conversion. Some of the wonderful conversions in the gospel, like Zacchaeus, like Mary of Magdala, for example, they seemed to have been absolutely terrible, but they were like the prodigal son in the parable of the prodigal son, that while they were doing awful things, their hearts were not actually closed against God. Whereas the people who are in the position of cardinals, bishops and priests today, who have all the right jobs, all the right clothes, all the right privileges and absolutely everything else, they might be the ones like the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal son, whose hearts are wrong. That's very, very, very sad. It's very sad. So look at 1 Corinthians 10 and 1 Corinthians 11, where Jesus speaks about sins that are committed during the Eucharist. So April the 16th, 1899. This is a preparation for communion. And again, Jesus speaks about sins given to him by his own. Now, his own are the people who are committed to him. These are the cardinals, bishops and priests and the religious. And obviously, whatever laity are really committed to him. While I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Jesus invited me to go around and see what the human creatures were up to. I said to him, my adorable Jesus, this morning I don't feel like going around and seeing the offences that they give you. Let's stay here, just the two of us together. Now, of course, that's the temptation we all have. Let's stay here just nice and cosseted and we don't have to look at it. But in actual fact, you do have to see what's going on so that you'll make reparation. But Jesus insisted that he wanted to go around, and so to make him content, in other words, to please him, I said to him, if you want to go out, let me rather go inside some churches. In other words, she thought it wouldn't be so bad to go inside churches rather than the so-called big bad world, because the offences that they give you are fewer there. So we went inside a church, but there also he was offended more than in other places. And this is the shock. Not because more sins are committed in the churches than in the world, but because these are offences given to him by his dearest ones, his closest ones. But everybody knows this in their ordinary everyday life. The people living on the next street to you are not the ones who cause you the greatest pain. They are the people in your own household, the ones that you call spouse and children and relatives and all the rest. They have the ability to cause you more pain than anybody else. So these are the offences given by his dearest ones, by the very ones who should lay down their soul and body to defend the honour and glory of God. This is why they reach his adorable heart more painfully. I could see devout souls. Now, devout souls to her seems to be, we would think lay people, but they seem to be religious and priests, but let's include the laity as well, who, because of bagatelles of no importance, you know, Shakespeare wrote a play called Much Ado About Nothing. And this is the me stuff. And you're getting all het up about absolute nothings. And she calls them bagatelles of no importance. They did not prepare well for communion. Oh, dear. Instead of thinking of Jesus, their minds were thinking about their little disturbances, about the many trifles. And this was their occupation. Oh, dear. I hope and I presume that you are not among these people. Most of the rest of us are. How Jesus pitied them and how much pity they themselves aroused. They paid attention to so many straws and so many specks, but then they didn't as much as give a glance to Jesus. They can even walk up to communion completely distracted. And they can be completely distracted afterwards. And then you have the scandal that people walk out after Mass and the first thing they're doing is gossiping outside. Do they even know they have received Jesus? So I want to give you Matthew chapters 1 to 6, or Matthew 6, 1 to 6, I think that should be. Matthew 6, 1 to 6. Jesus said to me, "My daughter, how these souls prevent my grace from pouring into them." Now, I can't think of anything more tragic than you're going to Mass every single day and at the same time preventing grace from transforming us. I can't think of anything worse. I do not look at trifles, but I look at the love with which they come to me. Yet they make an exchange. They pay more attention to straws than to love. But love is the issue. And in the 36 volumes of Louisa, I can summarize it for you, no problem. Divine will and love. If you go to Matthew 22, Jesus describes that love is the most important of all of the laws. And he says the whole of the scripture hangs on love. And love is the issue with God because God is love. Okay, so it's 1 John 4, 7, God is love. Love is the issue. When we go in death into God's kingdom, the only baggage you can take with you is love and everything that love contains. All the other trifles have to be left on the earth. So many good people who appear very good to us may in fact go to God without any baggage. And therefore they have to go to purgatory, unfortunately. I do not look at trifles, he says. I look at the love with which they come to me. Yet they make an exchange. They pay more attention to straws than to love. But while love destroys the straws, if only we received communion reverently, the Lord would deal with all of these nothings in our lives. With many straws, love cannot increase even a little bit. Oh dear. Rather, it decreased. So if we give all our attention to the straws, we don't give grace the opportunity to do anything to us. If we put the straws aside and go and receive Jesus with great love, love will actually deal with the straws. So they waste much time. They would like to spend entire hours with their confessors and talk to them about trifles, but they never get down to the work, to work with a good and courageous resolution in order to root the straws out. Now, Louisa is talking about something that was very common at the time that she is speaking about, which is over a century ago. And that is that people thought it was very holy to spend hours in a confessional talking to the priest about all kinds of total nonsense and straws, as you're told here, but minute details. And in the first four volumes of Louisa's writings, Jesus will tell us all to get rid of that junk because all you're doing is paying an awful lot of attention to yourself and paying no attention to love. And as long as all this attention is given to yourself, then there's no way you can grow. So they want to spend hours talking to the priest about these trifles, but they never get down to work with a good and courageous resolution to get these straws out of their lives. So it's an awful lot better to conquer yourself than keep talking about the stuff. What should I tell you then, O my daughter, about certain priests of these times? One can say that they operate almost satanically, reaching the point of making themselves idols of souls. In other words, the priests who are allowing people to come and sort of worship them as holy men because they listen to all of this nonsense. Oh yes, it is by my sons that my heart is pierced the most. Now, Louise isn't the only person to whom Jesus confided that. He confided that to many of his friends. That it is the priests that cause him the most trouble. And we who are living in this very, very sad age where priests and bishops and cardinals have scandalized the whole world with their behavior, we can only grieve. We can also make reparation. I shouldn't say we can only grieve. We can make reparation and we can make substitution to the Lord for them in the divine will. Ah, yes, it's by my sons that my heart is pierced the most. Because if the others offend me more, they offend me as members of my body. but my own offend me in my most sensitive and tender parts deep into my innermost heart. Okay. Who can say the torment of Jesus? In speaking these words, he was crying bitterly. I did as much as I could to sympathize with him and repair him. But while I was doing this, Jesus and I together withdrew into my bed. Okay. Now we're going to unfortunately hear an awful lot more about the sins of priests. April the 21st, 1899. Jesus is the poorest of the poor. This morning, while I was in my usual state, Louisa said, in one instant I found myself within myself, but without being able to move. I realized that someone was entering my little room, and then he closed the door again, and I felt he was drawing near my bed. In my mind, I thought that someone had entered furtively, without anyone of my family seeing him, and had penetrated even into my little room. Who knows what he will do to me? She thought. My fear was so great that I felt my blood freeze in my veins and I trembled all over. Oh God, what do you do? I said to myself, my family did not see him. I feel all numb and I cannot defend myself, nor can I ask for help. Jesus, Mary, my mother, help me, she cried out. Saint Joseph, defend me from this danger. When I realized that he was getting upon my bed and he curled up near me, my fear was such that I opened my eyes and I said, tell me, who are you? He answered, I am the poorest of the poor. I don't have a place to stay. I come to you if you want to keep me with you in your little room. See, I am poor and I don't even have clothes, but you can take care of everything. I looked well at him. He was a 5 or 6 year old boy without clothes, without shoes, but so very beautiful and graceful. Immediately I answered him, for me I would gladly keep you, but what will my father say? I'm not a free person who can do whatever she wants. I have my parents who prevent me. As for clothing you, I can do it with my poor toils. I will make any sacrifice. But as for keeping you here, that's impossible. Besides, don't you have a father? Don't you have a mother? Don't you have a place to stay? And the boy answered bitterly, I have nobody. Oh, please, don't make me wander any more. Let me stay with you. I myself didn't know what to do, how to keep him. A thought flashed in my mind. Who knows whether it is Jesus? Or maybe it's some demon to disturb me. So again I said to him, but tell me the truth at least. Who are you? And he repeated, I am the poorest of the poor. I replied, have you learned how to make the sign of the cross? He said, yes. Well then, make it. I want to see how you make it. So he signed himself with the cross. And I added, and the Hail Mary, do you know how to say it? Yes, but if you want me to say it, he said, let us say it together. I began the Hail Mary, and he was saying it together with me when a most pure light was unleashed from his adorable forehead, and I recognized that the poorest of the poor was Jesus. Why is he the poorest of the poor? Because he made this planet. He made it into a paradise, and he made all the creatures on it, and he has nowhere to stay. He has no heart to live in, and nobody will clothe him with love and anything. And so that's why he showed himself to Louisa as unclothed, because his clothing is love, because God is love. In one instant, through that light Jesus sent me, he made me lose consciousness again, that is going to ecstasy, and drew me outside of myself into an out-of-the-body experience. I saw myself all confused before Jesus, especially because of my many rebuffs. And immediately I said to him, my dear little one, forgive me. Had I recognized you, I would not have forbidden you to enter. And then, why did you not tell me it was really you? I have many things to tell you. I would have told them to you and would not have wasted so many time on useless things and fears. Besides, in order to keep you, I don't need my family. I can keep you freely because you don't allow yourself to be seen by anyone. But while I was saying this, he disappeared. And so it ended, leaving me a pain for not having told him anything that I wanted to tell him. Now notice that she is so determined to tell him what is in her heart that she's not paying attention to really what he's trying to reveal to her. And the mercy is that the Lord got her to write everything down so that we can learn that we have to pay attention to what the Lord is trying to communicate to us. and that we have to put it into practice. Now, of course, she will grow and she will be transformed. So I want to finish this segment with April the 23rd, 1899. The praises and scorns of others. There are two great impostors in life, and they are called praise and blame. Even people who are not Christians and the pagan philosophers were able to say this, because people can praise you for 101 reasons and they can blame you for 101 reasons, and none of the reasons for the praise or the blame may actually be correct. So if you're going to be wise, you put both praise and blame aside. And if you're working for the Lord, you only praise him and you don't blame him, of course, and you attribute everything you do to him. So she says, today I made my meditation on the harm that can come to our souls from the praises that other people give us. While I was doing this, the application to myself to see whether there was complacency for human praises within me, that's John 5:44, where Jesus said, you look for the approval of man, but not the approval of God. Jesus came close to me and he said, when a heart is full of the knowledge of self, the praises of men are like the waves of the sea that rise and overflow, but never out of their boundary. So the protection that we have is self-knowledge. If you know yourself thoroughly, then if somebody tells you something about yourself, you know whether they're just, it's eyewash, you know, or somebody just rubbing you up. In the same way, human praises yell and shout, they clamour, they get close even to the heart, but in finding it full and well surrounded by strong walls of knowledge of self, unable to find a place for themselves, they draw back, causing no damage to the soul. The damage is when you accept the praise and you start puffing yourself up, and what happens is secret pride begins to grow. Now, the worst of all diseases that you can get is actually secret pride, because you can't see it. It's an extraordinary mercy from God to get you to see pride. And once the secret pride gets in there, then Satan has a hook into your being. So this is what you must be careful about, taking the praises or the blame and the scorns of others into no account, whether they praise or blame. You just leave it all aside and only deal with the Lord. So I want to leave it there for this segment.